Letters on Sympathy by Sophia de Grouchy, first published in 1798. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Letters 1 and 2. Letter 1. The Root Causes of Sympathy. It seems to me, my dear friend, that man has nothing more interesting to think about than man himself. Is there really any activity more satisfying and enjoyable than to turn the soul's gaze on itself, to study its operations, to trace its movements, to use our faculties to observe and speculate about one another, trying to identify and grasp the hidden and elusive laws that govern our thoughts and our feelings? Furthermore, to be often with oneself seems to me the most pleasant way of life, and the wisest. It can blend the pleasures of wisdom and philosophy with those provided by strong, deep feelings. It puts the soul in a state of well-being that is the main ingredient in happiness, and the frame of mind most favourable to the virtues. Many people never achieve the moral stature and happiness that they could have attained because, hating it, or fearing it, or just not knowing about it, they do not live this life that perfects reason and sensibility together, making things better for oneself and for others. You know if I live such a life myself. I rank works that lead us back to ourselves, and make us live within our souls, second only to works that treat the primary means of assuring human happiness in society. However, I had not yet read Adam Smith's Theory of Moral Sentiments. I had heard bad reports of the French translation of this famous work, and I did not understand English well enough to read the original. I finally ventured to undertake this task, but instead of following this Edinburgh philosopher's ideas, I gave free rein to my own. In reading his chapters on sympathy, I made out of them other thoughts on the same subject. I will write them out for you, so that you can judge me. I don't say judge us, because I am far from claiming to be on a level with him. As you know, his opening chapters concern sympathy. Smith confined himself to noting its existence and showing its principal effects. I was sorry he did not venture to trace it back, getting through to its first cause, and finally showing how sympathy must belong to every being capable of feeling and thinking. You will see how I had the temerity to fill in these gaps. Sympathy is the disposition we have to feel as others do. Before examining the causes of the sympathy we feel when faced with a moral evil, we should examine the causes of the sympathy we feel when faced with physical afflictions. Every physical pain produces a compound sensation in the person who has it. It first produces a localized pain in the part of the body that the cause of pain initially acts on. It also produces a painful impression in all our organs, an impression quite distinct from the localized pain. It always accompanies the localized pain, but can continue to exist without it. To grasp just how distinct the two are, observe what is felt the moment the localized pain stops. Often one experiences both the pleasure caused by its stopping and a general feeling of malaise. This feeling of malaise is sometimes very painful. If particular causes prolong it, it can even become harder to bear than more intense, though short-lived, local pains, because the organs that are the main seat of the general impression are the most essential for vital functions, as well as for the faculties that enable us to sense and to think. This general sensation is renewed when we remember physical harms we have suffered. It is what makes the memory of them distressing, and some degree of it always accompanies this memory. Although this impression is doubtless capable of some variation, it is nonetheless the same for many very different local pains, at least when they have some similarities in intensity or in character. But when this impression would be different for different types of pain, e.g. from a broken bone and from damage to an internal organ, it can happen that the man who has felt them both does experience the same impression in recalling them. If time has weakened his recollection of them, or if he doesn't linger on them long enough for his imagination and memory to transmit to him the different sensations they involved. The painful impression we experience when recollecting past localized pains of our own is something we also feel as a response to pain being suffered by any other feeling creature. When we can see from the signs that he is suffering, or when we know in some other way that he is. In fact, as soon as we have an abstract idea of pain, thanks to the development of our faculties and the repeated experience of pain, that idea alone renews in us the general impression made by pain on all our organs. So there is an effect of pain that follows equally from both its physical presence and its moral presence. I'm using its moral presence to cover both the idea of pain that our memories give us and the idea we can have of it through seeing or knowing about others' pain. So sympathy for physical pains comes from the fact that what physical pain produces in us is a compound sensation, a part of which can be revived simply by the idea of pain. One can see now how a child who has developed to the point of being able to recognize the signs of pain in someone else sympathizes with the sufferer. How witnessing pain can affect the child to the point where he cries out and flees the scene. How he is more or less moved by the sight, depending on whether he has more or less knowledge of the signs of pain, and more or less sensitivity, imagination, and memory. The reproduction of the general impression of pain on our organs depends especially on sensibility and imagination. The intensity of this impression varies with the strength of our sensibility, and its likelihood of recurring is proportional to how intense the impression was, and to how good our imagination is at receiving and conserving all the ideas that can make it recur. Not only is the general impression of pain on all our organs reproduced by the mere idea of such pain, but the localized impression of pain is sometimes repeated when the memory or the idea of the pain strikes us vividly. That is how it happens that a man who has undergone a major operation, when recalling it in full detail, thinks he feels a part of the localized pain it caused him, and how someone with a strong or easily moved imagination, who sees a wounded man, besides the painful impression felt at the sight of pain, thinks he experiences a localized pain in the corresponding part of his own body. I knew a woman who, after reading a very detailed chapter on lung diseases in a medical work, had her imagination so worked up by the many causes that can harm this vital organ, that she thought she was experiencing some of the pains characteristic of lung congestion, and she had trouble ridding herself of this idea. There are plenty of examples of this sort of thing, especially among people whose soft and idle lives leave them with few defences against being misled by an overactive imagination. It is easy to see that the general impression produced by seeing physical pain recurs more easily when we see afflictions that we ourselves have also suffered, because then the impression is aroused both by our memories of our own pains and by seeing the effects of the pains of others. That is why pain and adversity are so effective in making men more compassionate and more human. It is a school that is needed by the rich and powerful, who are distant from the very idea of misery and misfortune, by the almost insurmountable barriers of wealth, egoism, and familiarity with power. Old folk, who have usually lost some of their sensibility, are inevitably less prone to have sympathetic reactions to physical pain in others. If one sees old people wilt easily and often shed tears, that is not because of strong sympathy, but from the weakness of their organs, which increases pain's power over them, so that the sight of pain is dangerous to them and can even shorten their lives. Why are surgeons, physicians, and others who provide care to suffering beings usually less affected than other men by the sight of pain? How, for example, do surgeons remain cool enough to probe a wound, to apply iron and fire to it, and to penetrate into delicate organs through bloody and torn flesh,
without the sight and sound of pain affecting their own organs enough to make their hands tremble, disturb their gaze, and distract their attention and judgment.
On thinking about it, we see that this is partly because the need to protect themselves from a pain that would be unbearable if repeated too often has hardened them against the impression of pain, even more because their habit of viewing their patient as someone to be saved gets in ahead of the painful impressions and blocks them, and finally because the idea of keeping the patient alive continually softens what they see of the patient's awful physical condition and what they hear of his screams and complaints. As regards the last of these, the urgent concern to save his fellow creature, and the focus he needs to work out how to do this, protects the surgeon from his impression of the pain. As soon as this impression might prevent him from being useful, beneficent nature keeps it away from him. There seems to be no need to prove that the more sensibility is exercised, the more it intensifies, up to the point where overstimulation makes it tiresome and unpleasant, and leads one to seek relief from it. A sensibility that is not exercised at all tends to weaken and can no longer be stimulated, except by very strong impressions. Voltaire wrote, "The soul is a fire that must be fed. If it doesn't grow, it dies." How important it is, then, to get children's sensibility to be active enough to reach the stage of development where it can no longer be dulled by things that tend to lead it astray, carrying us far from nature and from ourselves, centering our sensibility on all the passions of egoism or vanity, and taking us away from simple things, from a reasonable life, and from the natural inclinations in which each individual's true happiness resides. Happiness that does not sacrifice anyone else's and tends towards the good of all. Fathers, mothers, teachers, the destiny of the next generation is almost in your hands. Ah, how guilty you are if you allow to wither away in your children these precious seeds of sensibility that need nothing more to develop than the sight of suffering, the example of compassion, tears of recognition, and an enlightened hand that warms and stirs them. How guilty you are if you care more about your children's successes than about their virtues, or if you are more impatient to see them please a social circle than to see their hearts boil with indignation when they see injustice, their brows pale when confronted with pain, their hearts treat all men as brothers. Think less of their graces, their talents, and their occupations. Draw out from their souls all the feelings that nature has placed there. Make them easily remorseful and sensitive to the voice of honour and integrity. Let them be unable to see suffering without being driven by the need to relieve it. Let the gentle habit of doing good teach them that it's through their hearts that they can be happy, not through their titles, their luxury, their high rank, their riches. My venerable mother, dead now for 6 years, you taught me this. You whose footsteps I so often followed into the dilapidated homes of the unfortunate, fighting poverty and distress. Receive the lifelong homage I owe you every time I do good, every time I have the happy inspiration and the sweet joy of so doing. Yes, it was in seeing your hands relieve misery and illness, and seeing the suffering gaze of the poor turn towards you and become tender in blessing you, that I felt my heart come alive and saw the true good of social life laid out before me as consisting in the joy of loving humanity and serving it. The impressions of pleasure reach us through the same organs as the impressions of pain and follow the same laws. As with physical ailments, so all physical pleasure produces in us a particular sensation of pleasure in the organ that first receives it, accompanied by a general sense of well-being. And this latter sensation can recur at the sight of pleasure, just as the general impression of pain on our organs recurs at the sight of pain. So we can have sympathy towards other people's physical pleasures, as well as towards their afflictions. But this sympathy is harder to arouse, and consequently more rare.
because pleasure is less intense than pain, so that this general impression of pleasure on our organs is less easily awakened, and because nearly all physical pleasures have about them something inward-looking, something that shuts out everything else. And this conveys to us the idea and the feeling of deprivation, of something missing, which detracts from, and may even destroy, the agreeable impression that the idea of others' pleasure would otherwise arouse in us. So the sympathy that the sight of physical pleasure makes us feel is a feeling with less power over our soul than the sympathy inspired in us by the sight of pain. But it was important to recognize its existence, because it explains several phenomena of moral sympathy. You see, my dear friend, that the root causes of sympathy come from the nature of the sensations that pleasure and pain make us have, and that our status as beings who feel is what basically makes us capable of sympathy for the physical ailments that are men's most common afflictions. You will see in my next letter how this sympathy that starts with our feelings is completed by our thought. What do we not owe to sympathy? Right from its first faint beginnings, sympathy is the root cause of the feeling of humaneness that has such precious effects, counteracting some of the evils arising from personal interests in large societies, and battling against the coercive force that we encounter everywhere, and that only centuries of enlightenment can destroy by attacking the vices that have produced it. Amid the clash of so many passions that oppress the weak or shove aside the unfortunate, humaneness pleads, secretly but from the bottom of its heart, the cause of mankind fights back against the injustice of fate by awakening the sentiment of natural equality. End of letter 1. Letter 2. 3 topics. The sympathy we can have for physical pains, the sympathy that is one part of what we understand by humaneness, would not be lasting enough to be much use, my dear friend, if we could not think as well as feel. And just as reflection or thinking prolongs the ideas that the senses bring to us, so it extends and preserves in us the effects of the sight of suffering, and we could say that it is what makes us truly human. In fact, it's reflection that fixes in our soul the presence of an injury that our eyes have seen only for a moment, and incites us to relieve it so as to efface the nasty idea of it, reinforces our natural volatility, activating our compassion, by giving us a second view of something that had made a mere momentary impression on us at first, reminds us when we see suffering that we too are subject to this life-destroying tyrant, thus drawing us closer to the sufferer through a concerned feeling for ourselves that leads us to be concerned with his pains, even when our sensibility might find them repellent. And finally, conditions our sensibility by prolonging its activity, and so installs humaneness in our souls as a permanent sentiment that is always eager to spring into action, and unprompted seeks men's happiness through works of science, meditations on nature, experience, and philosophy, or attaches itself to suffering and misfortune, pursues them everywhere, and becomes humanity's comforter, its God. Thus humaneness, or the feeling for humanity, is a kind of seed planted deep in man's heart by nature, to be nurtured and developed by the faculty of reflection. But aren't some animals that are not capable of reflection capable of pity? Well, they are able to feel, and this is enough to enable them to sympathize with pain. But we do not know the nature and extent of any ideas they can have, so we cannot affirm or deny that some level of reflection enters into whatever compassion they are capable of. One of the animals most affected by the sight of pain, namely the dog, is also one of those that seem closest to human intelligence. Anyway, look at man himself, and you will easily see how he owes most of his humanity to the faculty of reflection. Indeed, it is to the extent that he has sensibility and reflection that man is human. Peasants and other folk whose occupations are closest to material concerns, that don't allow for reflection are less given to compassion than other people are. One of the main things the laws should aim at is to establish and maintain among citizens an equality of wealth, so that no citizen has to focus so exclusively on the necessities of life that he has no time for the degree of reflection needed for the perfection of all natural sentiments, and particularly for that of humaneness. Don't we also see that men in a less constrained and wealthier class, at a higher social level, are more or less human in proportion as they are more or less capable of sensibility, and especially of reflection? Beings preoccupied by unbridled passions, born of egoism or vanity, attentive only to their own goals, and not reflecting on anything except how to get what they want, aren't they always devoid of humaneness as well as of compassion? Just as the general impression of pain on our organs is renewed when we see pain or even merely remember it, so also it is produced by our abstract idea of pain, and consequently by our idea of pain's after-effects and of situations where pain is inevitable. This impression usually comes up in a more vague and indeterminate manner, because pain is brought home to us only weakly by the abstract idea of it. But when this idea offers us a new and extraordinary combination of pains, it can have as much effect as an actual pain. That is the source of the painful sensation we experience when we, without thinking of anyone in particular, turn our thoughts to the class of men doomed to the harshest labours, and to misery, or at least the terrifying threat of it, or when we, without thinking of any particular pain or hardship, are powerfully moved on hearing that someone has been reduced to poverty by an unexpected reversal of fortunes, or even if he is only threatened with that possibility. Thus the most abstract idea of physical pains, namely the idea of their possibility for someone we don't know, more or less strongly renews the general impression of pain on our organs. The idea of moral pain has the same effect. But to explain our sympathy with regard to moral suffering, shared by all the members of our species, we must go back to our particular sympathies, which are its causes, and then further back to their cause. My second topic is selective sympathy. Let us see first how we are inclined to sympathize with the distress of certain individuals, rather than with similar or equal distress suffered by other individuals. Quite apart from the moral proprieties that constitute the greater part of the happiness of those whose souls have been developed and exercised, quite apart from everything that makes civilized man happy, each individual depends on many others for necessities, for his well-being, and for life's conveniences. This dependence, though more extensive and more obvious in childhood, continues to a certain degree into later years. How strongly it does so, depending on how much space the person's moral development leaves for it. But because the extreme inequality of wealth reduces most men to providing for their own physical needs, most of the human species are condemned to a strict dependence on everyone who can help in satisfying their needs. The upshot is that each individual soon recognizes those to whom he owes the better part of his existence, the immediate and permanent causes of his hardships or his joys. He cannot be indifferent to their presence, or even to the mere idea of them, which unfailingly give him pain or pleasure. This dependence on some particular individuals begins in the cradle. It is the first tie that attaches us to our fellows. It causes the first smiles, and a child's most regular smiles are for his wet nurse. He cries when not in her arms, and for a long time he likes to throw himself upon this breast that satisfied his first needs, made him feel the first sensations of pleasure, and was the place where he eventually began to develop and form his initial life habits. Because the force of our sensibility depends on the state we happen to be in, and because the mere idea of the persons to whom we owe most of our well-being is sufficient for us to experience a feeling, we are predisposed to have emotions regarding anything that could happen to them. So their pleasures and pains must affect us more intensely than the pains and pleasures of other people. It comes down to this. Their suffering must move us more than anyone else's, because we regard these people as connected to us, and because, as they are so often present to our eyes and our thoughts, when they suffer, we must be moved by the idea of their current pain, and by the idea of the more or less long-lasting and more or less grievous ills their present state exposes them to. Because we are accustomed to feeling the ties that bind their existence to ours, the sight of their pains or pleasures makes us experience the feeling we would have at the idea of a danger or a good happening to us personally. And this happens by the force of habit alone, without any definite or conscious thought about our own interests. When civilization has reached a certain level, what I have said about our sympathy towards people who contribute to our happiness or help us to satisfy our needs extends to two other classes of individuals. First are those whom we can regard as resource or support in the face of mishaps that may threaten us. The connection this creates between them and us seems vague, less direct, less physical, so to speak, but it can become very close at certain levels of social development, where people are more concerned with their fears and hopes than with their needs, and where they are mostly living in the future. Secondly, there can also be a specific sympathy between folk who are drawn together by their tastes and habits, and find in one another's company a sense of being comfortably with their own kind. How strong this sympathy is depends on how large a role this sort of feeling plays in their happiness. My third topic is our enjoyment of tragedies. Perhaps you have wondered, my dear friend, given the disagreeable impression the sight or idea of pain spreads through all of our organs, why we like to recall the troubles we have undergone or witnessed, and why we are not satisfied with the emotions provided by real woes, and go looking for new ones in purely fictional accounts of the most frightful misfortunes and the most heart-rending circumstances. Why do all vibrant and tender souls, upon whom the impression of pain is stronger and more unfailing, enjoy renewing it by reading romances and tragedies and identifying with unhappy beings and devouring every detail of their misfortunes? Why do they continually seem to need to expend the full power of their sensibility on such things? There are several reasons for this need. I shall present three. Obviously, we are led to concern ourselves with the sufferings of others in order to relieve them, and this desire acts in us without our giving any thought to whether there is, or even whether there ever will be, any possibility of actually giving relief. This desire is at work when people on the shore stretch out their arms towards someone struggling in the waves and nearly drowning, a movement of sublime nature that unveils in an instant all the power of humanity over our hearts, and all the effects the legislator could derive from this sentiment, if it weren't more often weakened than strengthened by our institutions. We know from experience how useful it has been for us to have exact knowledge of things, and how important it has been for us to distinguish facts from fictions. That is the source of a sentiment of ours that habit makes natural and almost mechanical, so that we are often unaware of having it. When a combination of confused ideas is presented to our minds, or a vague picture of some event comes before our imagination, the sentiment I am talking about causes in us a discontented impression that compels us to clarify the confused combination, or delve into all the details of the vaguely imagined event. This is the same type of impression that we feel at the sight of pain. It has the same source. It is produced by the vague idea of a harm that might result from a real state of affairs that we don't know anything about. Thus we have a hidden impulse to know about the sufferings of others as soon as we suspect their existence, and in general to work out the details of every fact or combination of ideas of which we only have an incomplete notion. And this drive from concealed personal interest, if it concerns us, or from comparison, if it concerns others, is a significant cause of natural human curiosity. As soon as we are at peace regarding our physical needs, moral needs torment us, and we become liable to extreme discontent. Some people, especially those whose souls are subject to whims, calculation, and the empty pleasures of vanity, are given to discontent, because the desire for a more advantageous position than the one they have, the mere possibility of such a position, makes them disgusted with everything they possess, and desirous only of what they do not possess. Because the human heart, although hard to satisfy even by things that can bring it true contentment, is even more voracious and insatiable for things that can only fleetingly satisfy its needs. Other people, who have no new ideas, and can't generate any, because of the frailty of their minds or of their physical health, are captives of the malaise created by the state of their physical constitution. The troubles that they fear are coming to them, and the recollection or idea of their burdens. Many are tormented by boredom, only because they don't have enough reason and courage enough to exercise their minds, or enough experience and insight to recognize that the mind is like an instrument that overburdens and fatigues the hand that carries it, without using it. Boredom is thus one of the most cruel ailments of the human heart. It is so unbearable that to avoid it we are willing to give ourselves over to painful sensations, and the desire to avoid it is one of the causes that draw us to the idea of pain. Another more powerful, active, and continuous cause is our need to be moved, a need that we have, although we are sure to have more painful sensations than agreeable ones, with the former being more intense than the latter. This need to be moved is found not only among souls whose sensitivity and natural activity have been enormously developed by education, thinking, and emotional experience. It is easy to observe, even in the mass of people who are almost habitually insensitive. Isn't this attraction to all emotions, even painful ones, what leads the multitude to crowd around the scaffold, where they sometimes see tortures in all their horror, that nearly always melt them and make them weep? The human heart is somehow drawn to what agitates it and moves it. It senses that these emotions, coming from the outside, will distract it from the habitual impressions that it finds disagreeable or insipid, will save it from boredom, will extend its range, and by making the heart more pliant, will open it up to receiving new impressions, thereby enhancing one of its richest sources of enjoyment. Emotion thus seems fitting for the soul, just as exercise is fitting for the body, and the calm that follows seems to be the only one the soul can genuinely appreciate. The unpleasant emotions that we seek are almost always mixed with some pleasure, and the impression produced by these pleasures overcomes, or at least erases, the idea of pain. We know, for example, that when in the theatre we are about to surrender our soul to the grand sweep of a tragedy, the painful sensations that will be involved will be outweighed, erased, and outlived by the pleasures of the charm of the poetry, the novelty of the plot, the grandeur and originality of the characters, and the skill of the production and the acting, and by the pleasure of combining those pleasures with a sense of the effects the work is having on us, namely, of enriching our imagination and memory with images and new ideas, and feeling ourselves moved in new ways that can sometimes ennoble us and make us like ourselves better. This is so true that we rarely seek disagreeable emotions, in the way I have been describing, unless we are sustained by the hope of having agreeable ones later. We are not likely to reread a romance or tragedy that ends in a sinister catastrophe, unless the beauties of the art and the dramatic settings, constantly taking us from fear to hope, from tears of pain to tears of joy, make us forget at each moment the work's tragic and unhappy ending. You see, my dear friend, that nature has in a way made up for surrounding us by a crowd of troubles, by sometimes turning our pains into a deep source of our pleasures. Let us bless this sublime connection of the moral needs of some men with the physical needs of others, of the misfortunes to which nature and our vices subject us, with the leanings towards virtue
that are satisfied only when relieving misfortune. End of letter 2.